In January 1556, Shahanshah Humayun of the Mughal Empire fell from the stairs of his library and injured himself. He died of those injuries a while later. With his death, the future of the Mughal Empire seemed dire. The empire had barely been in his control for 6 months. Before this, he had wrested it from the Afghan Suri dynasty after having spent some 15 years in exile. From the time of his father Babur's invasion of India in 1526, the empire had never truly seemed stable. There was always a rebellion, always a war. Now, after Humayun, his young son Jalaluddin was put on the throne, who could easily have become a puppet king, would eventually become the greatest ruler of India. This video was sponsored by Magellan TV. Magellan TV is a streaming service that hosts over 3,000 documentaries and shows in various genres, from history to science, as well as travel and art. They're adding new shows all the time, which you can enjoy on all sorts of devices. Also, best of all, there are no ads and an increasing percentage of shows is available in 4K with no additional cost. They were kind enough to offer Al Muqaddimah viewers an extended free month-long trial. You can go to try.magellantv.com/Al Muqaddimah to take advantage of that. This week, I watched Codebreaker, Alan Turing, Persecution of a Genius, which tells the story of how the absolute Chad Alan Turing helped turn the tide of the Second World War and world history, and also how he was persecuted for being homosexual. Also, you should watch The Age of Hubble, which is a great documentary about the series of high-tech telescopes that scientists are using to study the universe and our place in it. Again, you can take advantage of a month-long free trial by clicking the link in the description. It would also help support the channel. Back to the video. Jalaluddin Muhammad was born in 1542 in Sindh in modern-day Pakistan. His father, Humayun, had no realm to rule at the time and was going around India looking for allies. While he didn't find many allies, he did get help from the Safavids of Iran, who lent him an army if he converted to Shiism, which, at least on surface, he did. Humayun invaded India, re-established the Mughal Empire, and 6 months later died in 1556, leaving the empire to his 13-year-old son, Jalal, who would be known to history as Jalaluddin Muhammad Akbar. Immediately, courtly powers started circling the boy king in the hopes of turning him into a puppet. One of those powers was Humayun's loyal general, Behram Khan. Behram Khan installed himself as the regent and led the army. However, his loyalty to the Mughal Empire ensured that he would do his best to help the empire. Sensing weakness, one general named Hemu raised his flags in a rebellion and seized Delhi. Behram Khan led the army against him and defeated him in the Second Battle of Panipat. Behram Khan then defeated the remaining Suri claimants and secured Mughal borders. As the empire became stable, another powerful figure in the Mughal court emerged. This one was named Mahamanga, Akbar's former wet nurse. She became Akbar's regent when he was at the court, while Behram Khan was his regent when he was on the battlefield. Mahamanga promoted her son, Adam Khan, to high positions, but he, in 1562, assassinated one of Akbar's highest-ranking ministers. As a result, Akbar had him thrown from a palace balcony, immediately killing him. Grief-stricken Mahamanga herself died shortly after. Akbar commissioned a tomb built over both their graves out of guilt. Around the same time, Akbar dismissed Behram Khan, claiming he was old and should retire to Mecca. Later, he was assassinated either by Akbar or by the Afghans whom Behram Khan had defeated. Akbar married one of his widows and adopted his 4-year-old son. This son, Abdul Rahim Khane Khanan, would eventually become one of Akbar's most important ministers. Akbar had now wrested the control of his empire from his regents and he was starting to come into his own. Immediately, he began eyeing Gujarat. Gujarat served as a vital port for all the goods from North India. It was also a refuge for the rebels and exiles from the Mughals. Along with the hostile Sultan, Afghan elements were found there. Would not only secure a vital port for the Mughals, but also secure their southern border and prove to the world the Jalal, or majesty, of Jalaluddin Muhammad Akbar. Although between Agra, Mughal capital, and Gujarat are the lands of Rajasthan, which were controlled at the time by the Rajputs. Before the arrival of the Mughals, the Rajput were seeking to dominate North India, but the Mughals had foiled that plan. Hence, there was a lot of hostility between the Rajputs and the Mughals. However, luck, it seems, was on Akbar's side. Out of the many Rajput clans in Rajasthan, the Kachwaha clan was the first to ally with the Mughals due to internal power struggle between the ruler, Raja Parmal, and his nephew. Parmal approached Akbar with an offer of alliance. In exchange for material support, he would give his daughter in marriage to Akbar. With Akbar's support, the Kachwaha became a powerful clan. Hence, more and more Rajput clans saw the benefits of allying themselves with the Mughals and did so. It usually had the same conditions, alliance and support in return for a daughter in marriage. Hence, as the Mughal Empire grew larger, so did the imperial harem. By 1568, most of Rajasthan was under the control of Akbar. The relationship between the Mughals and the Rajputs was a bit complicated but quite brilliant. Rajput leaders would join the Mughal court as advisors, ministers, and even governors while staying the rulers of their own clan. The entry of so many Rajputs into the court and the harem sped up the process of Indianization of the Mughals. At the same time, the Mughals circulated their own coinage in Rajput lands, and the Rajput had to ensure safety of merchants and pilgrims making their way across Rajasthan to Gujarat. Akbar even regulated the succession of allied Rajput clans. Rather than fighting and annexing all those clans, Akbar had, through diplomacy, tamed Rajasthan. An interesting figure who appeared from the Mughal-Rajput relationship was Man Singh, the grandson of Raja Parmal. While he ruled his own land, he also led the military for Akbar in many conquests and was made the governor of various regions such as Bengal. The only Rajput clan that didn't ally with the Mughals was the Sisodias, whom Babur, Akbar's grandfather, had first defeated around 4 decades earlier. In 1568, their major fort of Chittor was besieged, which fell but only after 30,000 soldiers made a last stand while their women committed Johar. Johar was a tradition where women of besieged forts and cities would burn themselves in order to avoid being dishonored by the enemy because, you know, a man's honor sits in the genitalia of his family's women. The Sisodias, however, would continue coming back. Akbar also brought reforms to the way land was distributed among his vassals. He started the Mansabdari system, where a numerical mansab or rank was assigned to people. This could go from 10 to 10,000, which was an indication of how many troops that mansabdar is supposed to provide to Akbar. This land grant or jagir was temporary and could not be inherited. Akbar moved people around a lot, so they weren't able to build support and power in one place. Akbar was seeking to reduce the importance of blood ties in his empire. No one ethnicity was given preference in Mansabdari, but rather achievements and skill were what mattered. He also circulated Persian classics like Al-Ghazali's theology and Rumi's poetry among his vassals to create a Persianized ethical framework that transcended blood and ethnic ties. In the 1560s and 70s, Akbar led his army all over India, expanding the empire greatly. In 1571, he moved his capital from Agra to Sikri, which he developed into a new town called Fatehpur, the city of victory. By 1584, the Mughals were able to finally sweep away the Sultanate of Gujarat and take it under their control. In the late 1570s and early 1580s, there were various rebellions in Mughal territories. This was inspired, if not supported, by the rise of Mirza Hakim, Akbar's younger half-brother. In 1581, Akbar led an army all the way to Kabul in pursuit of his rebellious brother. Hakim left Kabul and fled to nearby mountains. Akbar stayed in Kabul on the ancient throne his father and grandfather had once occupied, and then declared his sister Bakht-el-Nisa as the governor of Kabul. Mirza Hakim was defeated the next year, and he died a few years later, apparently of alcohol poisoning. Mirza Hakim's rise showed Akbar his northwestern weakness. The trade route that went from Central Asia to Delhi through Kabul was a vital one, not in the least because it brought war horses. So Akbar had to move closer to it to keep it stable. Hence, in 1586, he moved his capital for a third time to Lahore. Meanwhile, his trusted Raja Man Singh was sent to Kabul as its governor, and Akbar himself made a second visit in 1586. In 1586, Akbar also annexed Kashmir and then Sindh, the land of his birth, in 1590. During his years of conquest, Akbar showed brilliance in both diplomacy and warfare. he employed mounted archers from Central Asia and Rajput troopers from India. These two together made a devastating force that no one in India could stand up to. After conquest, though, Akbar didn't vanquish his enemies. He enrolled them into his own ranks and made them part of the Mughal Empire. He even sent his own robes to conquered vassals to make them feel what it's like to be a Mughal. Akbar replaced the powerful position of the vizier with four different separate roles. Chief Diwan, the finance minister, Mir Bakshi, the commander of the military, Khan-e-Saman, the royal chamberlain, and Ghazi al-Quzat, the chief judge. This system was replicated on smaller levels as well. Qazis were appointed to rule on judicial matters. An interesting thing is that in smaller towns and villages, the village council or panchayat decided on judiciary matters. However, Akbar also appointed qazis there, although they ruled according to local tradition and not Islamic law. Akbar still decided on the most important cases and was the only one who could hand out capital punishment. To get the commoners to accept his rule, Akbar tried to fit into the classic Indian figure of Sarvabhum, meaning universal ruler. He also employed, on both higher and upper levels of his government, locals so that they wouldn't feel left out and see him as an alien invader. While Akbar, in his propaganda and even his autobiography, claimed to be a universal, all-powerful ruler with none above him but God, the truth was that the state was very decentralized and locals held a lot of power. Akbar's brilliance comes from the fact that he knew everyone personally and kept them in check. He knew who could become powerful under what conditions, so he moved them around. Okay, now to the most interesting part of Akbar's reign, his religious policies. During the early years of his reign, Akbar wasn't really in control and the state wasn't all that tolerant. Akbar's name was attached to persecution of non-Muslims. However, when he came into power himself, he changed these policies. He had been raised under Shia, Sunni, and Sufi influences. At the age of 21, in 1563, Akbar abolished the pilgrimage tax, which was taken from all non-Muslims. The next year, he also abolished the jizya. It should be kept in mind that while jizya was technically the law, it was hardly ever enforced in India. He also banned the killing of cows and peacocks. In 1565, he went a step further and started sponsoring Hindu temples. He also made an annual pilgrimage to the shrine of Sufi saint Moinuddin Chishti. By 1577, he was seen participating in physical rituals of the Chishti order. It was also around this time that he founded the Ibadat Khana, meaning the house of worship. He invited scholars of all religions, including the Christians who had arrived in India regularly since Vasco da Gama. All these scholars discussed and argued over religious matters. Sounds like a fun way to spend an evening. Around this time, Akbar seems to have developed the idea that all religions were either equally true or equally false. During a hunting trip in 1578, Akbar seems to have had a spiritual experience. When he recovered, he ended the hunt, he adopted a mostly vegetarian diet, and shortened his hair. Akbar was trying to reconcile his leadership as the universal emperor and the many, many faiths of his subjects. He began taking control of religious leadership as well, starting with Islam. He began delivering the Friday sermon himself from time to time. He also issued a declaration in 1579 that he was the ultimate authority on religious matters in the empire, styling himself as Zil-e-Ilahi, the shadow of God. However, this was also when Akbar began moving farther from Islam. During his expedition to Afghanistan in 1581, a Christian priest in his entourage claims that Akbar confided in him that he wasn't a Muslim anymore and he wanted his sons to follow whatever faith they wanted. Though just because he might not have been Muslim anymore doesn't mean he was a Hindu or a Christian. He was trying something new. Here's Philip from Let's Talk Religion to talk more about Akbar's Din-e-Ilahi.
The Din-e-Ilahi, or Divine Religion, was a religious movement founded by the Emperor Akbar, which served as a kind of culmination of his religious activities. He never referred to it himself as the Din-e-Ilahi, but rather as Tawhid-e-Ilahi, or Divine Monotheism, which tells us at least a little bit about its supposed beliefs. However, when it comes to this phenomenon, there's a lot of disagreement among scholars and in our sources. Some claim that the Deen Ilahi represents a new religion entirely, that Akbar founded a new religion that was separated from his religion of birth, which was Islam. Others think that this is an inaccurate description, instead emphasizing the Deen Ilahi as a, you could say, at least in Akbar's mind, as being an extension or part of his already existing Sufi-oriented Islamic faith. What is relatively certain is that the Deen Ilahi was the result of Akbar's interactions with various religious traditions. He had established the Ibadat Khana, the House of Worship, where he hosted representatives from basically every religious sect in the region, various Muslim denominations, what we call Hindus, Buddhists, Christians, Zoroastrians, etc. And they held debates and discussions here on religious and spiritual questions. The so-called divine religion or divine monotheism seems to have grown out of this, taking inspiration from the debates and teachings from a variety of different religious traditions, with Akbar himself in a very important position as a spiritual leader or guide for its followers. What is important to remember is that Akbar and his intellectual endeavors weren't as unique as you might think. There had long been interactions between Muslim scholars or saints and other religions in the region, so Akbar is really part of this wider tendency at the time. The fact that he saw similarities and value in the teachings of other religions and adopted aspects of them wasn't all that unusual, and does not necessarily indicate that he ever stopped being a Muslim or that the Deen Ilahi was a new religion. But sadly, when it comes to the actual beliefs and practices of this movement, we don't know much at all, and what we do know often comes from sketchy sources. But these sources claim that this movement contained elements of primarily Sufi-oriented Islam, but also religions like Hinduism, Zoroastrianism, and perhaps Jainism and Christianity. When we look at this movement, it sometimes appears more like a secret society rather than a religion of its own. Only a select few were initiated. They had unique ways of saluting each other, unique practices and prayers. It reminds us somewhat of a Sufi order, actually, which wouldn't be all that surprising given Akbar's attachment to Sufism in particular. There seems to have been a kind of code of conduct that the initiates were to follow, like abstinence from worldly desires, soft speech, and a general conduct based on justice, kindness, and devotion to God. There may have been an encouragement to live in celibacy and emphasis on different practices to purify the soul on its journey to God. Perhaps inspired by the common Indic notion of ahimsa or non-violence, the Ilahans may have been told to abstain from all use of violence, forbidding the slaughter of all animals, to hold a vegetarian diet, and even to avoid dining together with people associated with such things like butchers or fishermen. The name Tawhid Ilahi tells us, and its Islamic character suggests, that the movement was fundamentally monotheistic. Some sources, mostly critical, tell us that, much like in Zoroastrianism, light, especially in the form of fire and the sun, became associated or became a symbol for God and was thus worshipped in some sense. But what was perhaps the most important aspect of this religious movement was Akbar himself. This group clearly revolved entirely around him as a kind of leader and guide. Some even claim that he saw himself as divine, since there were rings and letters sealed with the phrase Allahu Akbar, and also that this phrase was used as a salutation among initiates. And aside from this phrase, Allahu Akbar, meaning God is great, we can also mean God is Akbar. Did the Deen Ilahi consider Akbar to be divine? It's very hard to say for sure. The sources are varied and give us different accounts entirely on this movement in general. Part of the reason for this is perhaps the fact that the movement never had more than 19 adherents, and that it basically died out after Akbar passed away, perhaps not surprising given his central role. But in spite of our lack of certain knowledge on the details of this movement, it is one of the most fascinating aspects of Akbar's vast legacy.
Thank you, Philip. Over on Let's Talk Religion, Philip has made an entire video about Akbar's religious views, so after you're done watching this one, be sure to check it out. Links in the description. While Akbar was trying a new religion, he was also trying to fit into the role of the classical Muslim sovereign. He was full of contradictions, okay? The year 1591 of the Common Era was the year 1000 of the Islamic Hijri calendar. Akbar saw himself as the one ushering in the second millennium of Islam. But again, he also saw himself as the ultimate authority. In 1585, he issued coins that read, Allahu Akbar Jalla Jalaluhu. Allahu Akbar means God is great, but can also mean God is Akbar, or Akbar is God. Also, his given name Jalal also makes an appearance in this statement. He also started greeting the sun every morning from the highest point in the palace and even memorized the 1001 Sanskrit names of the sun. In fact, he adopted so many Hindu practices that the Christians who were hoping to convert him abandoned their attempts, thinking he'd never become Christian. Around the year 1601, just 4 years before his death, Akbar became Muslim in practice again, even if it might have been just to silence his critics. The great Mughal Shahnshah, Jalaluddin Muhammad Akbar, died on 27th of October, 1605. He left behind an India that was secured and united under the control of his son, Shahnshah Nuruddin Muhammad Jahangir. His empire now had institutions, structure, and bureaucracy. It looked very different than the empire Akbar had inherited. It was a proper Turco-Mongol state, but at the same time, it was equally Indian. Akbar is remembered in many ways today. First, for his tolerance and embrace of the greatly diverse peoples of the Indian subcontinent. Secondly, he is remembered as the great conqueror and administrator that he actually was. While Din-e-Ilahi wouldn't prove to be a permanent fixture in the Mughal throne, he is also remembered for his attempts to become a universal ruler and his divine claims. In romantic stories such as Mughal-e-Azam, he is remembered as the strict father who stood between his son Prince Salim and Anarkali, the courtier Salim loved so dearly, whom Akbar eventually walled up alive. Whatever aspect of this emperor you choose to look at, he does come out to indeed be Mughal-e-Azam, the greatest Mughal. See you next time. Don't forget to subscribe and press the bell icon. On screen right now, you can see the names and tiers of the patrons. You can join them by pledging a dollar or more to support the channel. Thank you for watching.